Welcome, everyone, to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown. On today's episode, we will be examining the factors that are involved in setting workers' wages. Is it the market, the firm, or a combination of influences that determine the money you take home? Here to discuss is our very special guest, Professor David Card. Dr. Card is a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and director of the university's Center for Labor Economics. Before joining Berkeley, Professor Card taught at the University of Chicago and Princeton University, and has held visiting appointments at Columbia, Harvard, and UCLA. Professor Card's research interests include wage determination, education, inequality, immigration, and gender-related issues. He has co-edited 8 books and published over 100 journal articles and book chapters. In 1995, Professor Card received the American Economic Association's John Bates Clark Prize, which is awarded to the economist under 40 whose work is judged to have made the most significant contribution to the field. In 2021, he served as president of the AEA and was also co-recipient of that year's Nobel Prize in Economics. Professor Card, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Professor, thank you so much for taking the time. We're very happy to have you on the show today. Over the years, you have put out quite a bit of excellent research, but today we are going to focus on a paper you published earlier this year titled "Who Set Your Wage?" Now, most people, especially economists, will reflexively respond, "The market, of course, set my wage." But your research tests the long-held theory that wages are set by marginal products, because you note that that can only be the case when there are perfectly competitive markets and when there is no monopsony in wage setting. You also note that the field has mostly relegated the notion of monopsonistic wage setting to small towns with only a single employer. So to start us off, can you walk us through some of the, I guess, the key points of your paper and perhaps tell us a little bit about some of the gaps in the literature?
Sure. Well, the idea of the paper is really a kind of an overview of recent trends in the area in the last, say, 15 years. And I was motivated to write it. It's actually my presidential address from the American Economic Association, but I was motivated to write it because I thought that there was a lot of new research coming out that seems to be pretty strongly supporting the idea that firms have some market power in setting wages. So when I say who set your wage, obviously I'm thinking of it like who set the price for the gas you bought to fill your tank this morning. You know, it was obviously set by the company that runs the retail outlet that you went to, and you know, you could have gotten a slightly different price. And sometimes in some situations, that's a remarkably variable price for the gasoline that you buy.
Sure.
Even though, of course, there is a market for gasoline, any given seller has some power in setting their price, and they might take into account, you know, how easy it is to get in their driveway, how close it is to the freeway, how many other competitors there are nearby, whether it's a branded type of gasoline and so on. And I think those same forces are really present in the labor market. And so I think what's happening in labor economics is adopting some of the ideas that are pretty widespread in modeling prices and thinking about using them to model wages. For example, I remember when the internet first kind of started an electronic commerce came in, there were quite a few people who said, well, this is going to be great. We're going to have electronic commerce. Prices are going to go really rock bottom, and everybody's going to pay one price or the same kind of market price for whatever it is that's sold on the internet.
Right.
And it turns out that nothing could be further from the truth. The internet has sort of created this amazing, confusing mess of prices. So you can see the same product advertised for many different prices and available all over the place. And it's, and I think to some extent, that's also true with the labor market. When you ask me about, you know, the idea that the monopsony theory, monopsony is the equivalent of monopoly, but it means a single buyer of labor. It's kind of a misnomer because people don't think of there being only one buyer for their services. What they think is that any given buyer, there might be some reason why you prefer to work for one company versus another. And so you'd be willing to go to work for, you know, I'd be willing to work for Berkeley for a little bit less than I'd have to get if I was going to go to work at Stanford, because I like the weather better in the Bay, or because, you know, there's, I like my colleagues at work, or because there's some other feature of that job. So that's the kind of modern way of thinking about monopsony, is that there's not any single buyer. There are a few job situations where there's really only a couple of employers, but even if there's many employers, there can nevertheless be idiosyncratic reasons why you want to, you know, just like you, there's an idiosyncratic reason why you want to buy your gas at one gas station that's at, you know, $6.50 versus $6.
Right.
So in my town, Berkeley, you can definitely go easily find a 10% or 15% difference in prices. And that's the kind of thing you're thinking about in the monopsonistic model of the labor market, maybe 15, 20% of a variation in wages that you get in different employers.
So in the paper, you talk a bit about Robinson's double wedge between marginal productivity and wages. In essence, that firms mark up prices over marginal costs and mark down wages relative to the value of marginal products. But you also note that, I guess, as a modeling approach, this framework doesn't hold. Why is this? Is this not the world in which we all live? Because it makes sense to a lot of us.
No, I think it is actually a fairly relevant model for a lot of situations. I mean, there might be some kinds of markets where the firm is actually producing things that are sold like pure commodities, like farmers. So you can imagine wheat farmers and Nebraska or whatever. I guess there's not too much wheat in Nebraska, but Montana would have essentially the price that they're going to get for their wheat is all the same. So they don't have any, one of the wedges is not present for them, but nevertheless, you know, different farmers would pay different wages for the crews that come and help them do different farm chores. So that would be the one possibility. But I think generally speaking, for most jobs, the employer, you know, employers normally have some market power for whatever they're selling, especially more successful ones. So, you know, obviously, a firm like Apple has enormous market power in some markets, maybe a little bit less in others. And that's one of the wedges. So they're obviously setting prices a little bit above their cost. It seems like they must be, so because the profits are definitely fairly substantial. And then there's the markdown is the new wedge that this monopsonistic literature is trying to bring in. And Robinson, you know, wrote her book in 1933, and she really pointed out that there was sort of almost a symmetry between buyers and sellers. Why should there be market power in one and not in the other?
Right.
But there's a lot of different reasons that I'm not entirely sure any of them are worth, you know, really completely right as to why that theory didn't take off. Initially, there was some interest in it, but then it kind of disappeared after the war, after World War II. It really has only come back, I would say, in the last 15 years.
So what does your research say about the markdown of wages to marginal revenue?
I haven't done as much direct research on that particular parameter or measure. I've done two related things that are possibly relevant. One is showing that if you use large data sets that are available for a lot of countries, including the US, where you can watch a worker move between jobs, you see remarkable variation from job to job in this way.
Right.
The same worker gets paid. And it's pretty systematic. So it's not the case that, you know, I go from one place to another and get 10% raise and you go and get zero or minus 10 for the same move. Pretty systematically, there appears to be firms that effectively pay everybody a little bit more and others that pay everybody a little bit less. And you know, why that is in this empirical side of research is not really addressed. It's sort of saying there's this really systematic difference across employers in what they pay. And so my work has been, a lot of my work has been sort of documenting that and showing what that matter, how that matters for things like the gender gap or the black-white wage gap or for wage inequality.
Right.
Then a second thing I've done is try to relate. There's kind of a longstanding phenomenon that everybody, again, everybody's kind of familiar with, which is if a firm is more profitable, tends to pay higher wages. And that's true, not just, you know, Apple pays higher wages than not very profitable firms, but it's also the case that when a firm has some good times, to some extent, wages go up for workers. And in a contribution I did a couple of years ago with my colleague Pat Klein and two other colleagues, Jorkining and Anna Cardozo, we sort of showed that if you have a monopsonistic model, that's a prediction that there would be some pass-through of good times to wages.
Right.
And again, it's very similar in a way to the other side of the market, the price side. You know, so for instance, in the IO literature, industrial organization literature, there's quite a bit of work on what happens when there's an exchange rate shock to, say, the price of Japanese cars. So suppose the Japanese yen falls by 15%, which I guess it's sort of done in the last few months. Do we expect Japanese cars in the United States to fall by 15%? If it was a perfect competitive market, we would.
Right.
If the firms have some markup power, we wouldn't. And it's exactly that idea that's true in the labor market as well. And so that if you're a perfectly competitive firm, just because the firm's doing well, it shouldn't have to pay higher wages.
Right.
Unless they're, well, you know, trying to be nice or something.
Well, yeah, let's talk a little bit more about profitability. Can you talk a little bit about how the relationship between profitability and wages and how, I guess, the decline in unionization has affected that relationship?
Well, there is pretty systematic relationship between profitability, some different measures. There's different measures of profitability, first of all, and you can get a little bit confused about that. So let's say we thought one measure would be something like value added per worker. That would be kind of a standard measure that you can measure that in lots of different countries and some other places. Sometimes it's harder, but so what you see if you use that kind of measure is if the firm's value added per worker is 10% higher, wages would maybe be 1 or 2% higher. Not enormous rate of pass through, maybe 10%, 20% kind of pass through of productivity to wages, measured that way. Now whether that was different in the old unionized days, I have to say I don't know. Research showed that union wages were related to profitability of firms, but there were some interesting exceptions. Mm-hmm. For instance, the United Auto Workers, their policy was to charge more or less the same wage to GM, Ford, Chrysler, and American Motors and Studebaker. And eventually Studebaker stopped making cars. They said, we can't keep up. They didn't go broke, but they just got out of the car business. And similarly, the mine workers had that policy. They had a policy of sort of setting a single wage and essentially saying, okay, well, maybe we'll lose some firms if we don't care. So you could make an argument that there was less flexibility in the unionized sector than, you know, to productivity on a firm specific basis. In fact, that was one of the criticisms of those old union settings. Of course, that's pretty irrelevant now in the private sector in the U.S.
So it's pretty evident that more profitable companies pay higher wages and that workers with more marketable skills are actively seeking out those companies. I would make sense that they would. Do you find that the wage premium that is being earned by qualified workers is increasing? And, you know, if so, how does that how does that affect income inequality in the years to come?
Well, the gap between different skill groups in the labor market, that gap is kind of bottomed out in the late 1970s. And there were a lot of different factors. One of my old friends, a professor at Harvard University named Richard Freeman, in the late 1970s wrote a book called The Overeducated American.
Great title.
Bad timing, but he argued, it was a serious book. He argued that there was now so many people getting college degrees in the United States that there was too many workers and not enough demand, and it was driving down the benefits of a college degree. Now, basically, from the day that book was published on, that gap has widened steadily. And now people are writing the opposite book, saying that we're not really keeping up. The race between technology and education is a book, roughly the title of a book by Larry Katz, who's one of Richard's colleagues, another Harvard guy, saying that in fact we're no longer keeping up. So the general view seems to be that skill differentials have been pretty much rising, maybe steady a little bit for 4 or 5 years and then rising again, inching up. They're particularly the one that everybody is most familiar with is the gap between the very, very top, CEOs or most successful accountants or most successful academics. So that's sort of the top 1 or 2% of the workers in every field and everybody else, that gap has really shot up enormously.
Right.
Performers, artists and everything else is also the case. And that has definitely attracted a lot of attention in terms of inequality and so on. Now, whether some of that may be due to firms, because what's happened with the worker firm and the worker firm side is that, as far as we can tell, and the data on this is a little sketchy in the US, it's better in other countries, but as far as we can tell, the very highest skilled workers are more and more likely to work at these really big, really profitable, really successful firms. So they already started with really high wages and then they go to the high paying firm. So that kind of doubles down on the inequality effect. And some of those same co-authors that I mentioned before, we wrote a paper showing that enhanced matching between workers and firms, high wage workers more and more likely to work at high paying firms, contributed a really important share of the rise in wage inequality in Germany since the 1980s.
So are there spillover effects in wage settings? I saw a video of a talk that you gave, and are there any spillovers in wage setting? For instance, assuming that we control for differences in company profitability and cost of living, does an accountant in, let's say, Kansas City stand to make more money by moving to Palo Alto simply because, I guess, productivity per worker is higher there than it is in Kansas City?
Yeah, so that's a long-standing issue in what's called economic geography. And one of the big puzzles is, why are wages so much higher in, let's say, basically the East Coast and the West Coast are the high-wage parts of the United States. So New York, San Francisco, Boston, Washington, D.C., Seattle, Los Angeles are all pretty high-wage places. And especially the Southeast, pretty low-wage, Atlanta, Houston, Dallas, those places are pretty low-wage, relatively speaking. So I've investigated that phenomenon generally. It turns out that something like 2/3 of the difference in average wages is higher quality workers. So the workers who are living in, let's say, Washington, D.C., which is, the third highest or fourth highest paying city, those workers would earn substantially more and did earn substantially more in other places before they moved there. But there's also some extra premium for working in DC. So about a third of the overall net advantage to working in DC is basically a pure premium, like these kind of firm premiums that I was talking about. So you can literally see people going along, they're working quarter, here, and then all of a sudden they move and their wages jump up, or right. They move the other way and their wages jump down. You can see that right. Very quick.
So I guess, aware of these spillovers or not, it seems workers have left smaller cities and moved to bigger cities. And I grew up in a small town in Georgia. And you talk about the low wages in Atlanta. I grew up in a town where the talented workers are actually leaving that city to go to Atlanta. So do we, and it's one of the perpetual issues that is facing my hometown is convincing them to stay. Are we going to see a sort of a continuing hollowing out of smaller cities?
I think that trend seems to be pretty difficult to stop. Over the period from about 1950 on, we've got pretty good data that we can follow, you know, workers and look at their characteristics and stuff. And pretty much over that period, it was more or less steady. You know, there was slowness in the 70s. I think people were kind of, that wasn't the greatest time for many American cities. So it kind of slowed down, but then it kind of resumed with the vengeance in the 80s and 90s. So it does seem like the long run trend is for a higher fraction of people to be living in closer to or in cities, but also, and very importantly, for the highest educated workers to be very concentrated in big cities. Some of that presumably is because of these premiums. Some of it might be the kind of things that higher wage workers prefer to buy with some of their extra money, like a diversity of restaurants or cultural attractions, proximity to universities. Some of it may be that's where their jobs are. You know, so if you're thinking of where are the very highest paying jobs in terms of companies, like all the Silicon Valley and tech companies are on the West Coast, basically, with some branch offices in DC and Washington and New York. But so you basically want to work in the tech sector, you kind of have to live in one of those places, except then the COVID Zoom thing kind of threw a little wrench into that. So sure. It's possible that some of those forces will mediate a little bit over the next few years. No one seems 100% sure how that's going to come down.
Right. Well, everything that we've talked about and in your paper, it seems that there's much more involved in wages and wage setting than simply being compensated for the job at hand. What would you say, is there any research or perhaps the best research that attempts to extract the various components of wage setting, for instance, the proportions that are dedicated to minimum wage laws, to firm profitability, to national economic performance versus the actual requirements of the position?
Yeah. So usually if you have a really large data set and you can see workers moving between firms and you can see the same worker working at many different jobs, many different employers, you can kind of do a partition then and say, okay, how much of this does this worker get paid no matter where they work? That now some of that is there are whatever occupation they're in, some of it is their, even if they're in an occupation, they're extremely motivated or they're not as money hungry and all these kind of things. So if you do it that way, you would get about 20% of the overall variance is who they work for. Mm-hmm. About 70% is who they are. And then 10% is just pure noise.
Oh, wow.
There's always noise.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty low rate of noise for most economic variables. So it's overwhelmingly the kind of human capital side. We could call it for old-fashioned labor economists. Now, how much of that, what we don't understand exactly is where does that all come from? Is that all, some of it is obviously from, you know, the their parents and the connections that they have and how much their mother put into their learning their alphabet before they started school and all those right. things. Some of it is what school they went to. Some of it is what program. There's a huge variability in terms of what degree you have these days. That inequality has really risen a lot in the last 20 years. So the difference right. between a humanities degree and a business degree or a computer science degree, that's really blowing up like crazy. Some of it is on average, some people seem willing to take kind of tougher jobs. Like some jobs are kind of unattractive. No one would, you know, many of us probably wouldn't want to work in finance if we didn't have to right. earn a lot of money or something. Other people would, you know, really enjoy it because they really like the money, but you know, it's not the job for everyone.
Yeah.
So there's lots of examples of those features, but in any case, overall, it's overwhelming on the person. And so a lot of research is really focused on where does that come from?
Right. Well, I have to ask you this next question because it's been on my mind. What I find so interesting is that economists believe the market creates jobs and sets salaries, whereas you know many CEOs and even politicians tout themselves to be job creators. Do you find any evidence to support David Graeber's theory and others have talked about it that most jobs are quote unquote bullshit jobs. And if so, wouldn't that mean that the firms are in fact job creators to some extent? What are your thoughts on that?
I have worked in lots of different sort of settings as a consultant in addition to my academic job. And so many people think an academic job is kind of a bullshit job, for example. But to tell you the truth, I mean, it's a pretty tough job.
Yeah.
Very few people who started actually succeed. It's pretty tough to persist in it. It doesn't pay that much considering how many long hours you work and stuff.
Right.
I think there's evidence that like a single firm can make a difference, partially through their innovation. So you could make an argument that Google, for instance, invented lots of different things and helped foster the climate of innovation that created, recently this whole trend to what's called deep learning in artificial intelligence. You can
right.
very, you know, that particular thing you can trace to a certain set of programs that Google researchers put together and copied and, you know, that, so that little notch in technological growth, you might say, well, it was probably going to happen, but they got there first and they really pushed it forward and along. And so you could give them, I think, a fair amount of credit for that. And you could do the same thing with General Motors and the automatic transmission, you know, they did a great job with that back when they first created the fluid drive transmission system that we now, you know, take for granted. So I would say there's always some role for individual contributions in all these things. Now, what is everybody doing at all these companies? That's a very good question. But it does seem like right now, for instance, the demand for workers is really off the charts still, even though
right.
the economy is starting to look a little dodgy. You know, there's still lots of vacancies, and there's a lot of firms, I think, all through COVID, were really getting by with the workforce under a lot of stress. So, you know, especially like in the hospitals and healthcare and to some extent police and other kinds of services like that, those guys were working their butts off.
Yeah.
And so you might walk into a hospital and say, there seems to be a lot of people standing around. That's true.
Right.
But nevertheless, it's pretty obvious that they were actually working extremely hard, and they're probably working too hard. They need
right.
to, you know, add another 5% to the workforce to kind of keep everything copacetic.
Right.
So I think that it's easy to think of everyone. I mean, when people talk about something like bullshit jobs, I always think, well, is it that you think everybody else's job is bullshit and yours isn't, or do you think your job is bullshit? So I think we have to clarify that definition a little further before we go too much, you know, down that road.
Right. Right. Well, one final question to wrap things up. I know you're very busy, but You note in the paper that by insisting that market set wages, labor economists have ceded the field of wage setting. And it's clear from our chat that there are far too many factors involved to warrant an explanation as simple as market set wages. So what do you think are some of the areas that you feel need greater scrutiny in labor economics and specifically in the study of wage setting?
Oh, I think there's a huge amount of young people, the younger researchers these days, working on topics like how knowledgeable are workers about their other opportunities? Like, why are you sitting working at this firm when it seems like there's another firm nearby that actually pays a higher wage? What exactly is keeping you in your place? What's the sources of the frictions, we would call it? So that's one set of topics. Another set of topics is how do firms actually set wages? Do they basically post a wage for a position and try and find a person to fill it, or do they negotiate on a person-by-person basis? Or is it something kind of very complicated in between? And how does that, you know, how much of your wage is the wage that they were going to offer for any schmuck who walked in the door versus how much you managed to, you know, weasel them up another 10% before you signed on the dotted line? That kind of element of how much bargaining power or ability to negotiate you have, and does that vary across education groups or gender or race? So there's a lot of interest in that. There's a lot of interest in all of the stuff relating profitability of firms to how good a job firms seem to be creating, and this pass-through parameter. Mm-hmm. Quite a bit of interest in antitrust sort of things, like is there evidence that when two large firms that employ similar workers merge, that wages are depressed?
Right.
And there's starting to be, I think, quite a bit of evidence on that side of things, and conspiracies there. You know, like there's constantly in the healthcare sector, there's groups of large employers coming in and sort of taking over the doctors and so on. And I wouldn't be surprised if we find in the next few years that a lot of that is involving suppressing wages. So you can say, okay, all the physiotherapists in Texas are, you know, controlled really by one or two firms. Those guys get together in the golf club and say, you know, maybe we could cut back a little bit on the competition.
Right.
It sounds kind of far-fetched, except that, you know, the tech companies did it for almost 20 years.
Right. Right.
So there's a very strong empirical record that, you know, this kind of thing can happen.
Right. Well, Professor, thank you so much for taking the time out to join us today. And I know it's just been a great chat. I've learned a lot, and I know our listeners have learned a lot. So thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Edward. Thank you.
If you want to get more David Card, make sure to visit davidcard.berkeley.edu to get access to all of his research. That's it for us here at The Demand Side. I hope you enjoyed today's episode with our very special guest, David Card. Make sure to check out all the episodes of The Demand Side on The Demand Side's landing page, wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to visit thedemandside.com for access to opinion pieces, books, news, and videos. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose The Demand Side. Until next time. Thank you.